Four Hit Parade, starring Frank Sinatra.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
And now, smile a while with Lorenzo Jones and his wife, Belle.
Here's the Manhattan merry-go-round that brings you the bright side of life, that whirls you in music to all the big night spots of New York town, to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly you can understand every word and sing them yourself.
This is the Golden Age of Radio. I'm Dick Bertel, and tonight we'll take you on another audio excursion back to radio's formative years. You'll hear the programs that made the era golden, and meet people who made those broadcasts a reality.
The Golden Age of Radio is brought to you by WTIC and Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank and their Cromwell Savings Bank Division. Hometown friends serving your best banking interests in every way. Now, here is your host, Dick Bertel.
Good evening, and with me once again is radio historian collector, Ed Corcoran.
Well, tonight, Dick, we have an author, a man who not only wrote for radio, but was in motion pictures and did such shows as Gangbusters, We the People, and many, many more, Dick.
Will Yolen is his name, and Will, it's a pleasure to have you here on the program. You're at Yale right now. What are you doing there?
I'm involved as a special student in a literary modernism course and in a philosophy course called Argumentative Philosophy, and it sure beats me on how you can never lose if you take that course, if you get into an argument anyway.
I suppose.
And a good shot across the chops will do more for argumentation than anything else that I know.
Well, I firmly believe in that myself at times. Will, you have a varied background, as Ed has just outlined, but when I read about you, you're involved in so many things. You've written 12 books, one of which is the definitive book on kites and kite flying. I'm curious to know how you got into that, incidentally.
That is in the opening chapter, and I urge you to get that book and read it, because I'm going to give you a quiz on it.
All right. You're going to ask questions.
But I really got started when I was middle age. After the war, I came back, and I was a freelance writer living in New York City with the wife and kids to support. And I had a brother-in-law, Edward Garrick, who was the chief physicist for the NASA, who came up to read a scientific paper with his colleague, Francis Regalo, who had invented the first non-rigid kite. That's a kite with no sticks in it. After 2,000 years of stick kites, up comes this guy with a non-rigid kite. No sticks. He used shroud lines instead of sticks. Shroud lines as in a parachute.
Yeah.
And this kite was used in the wind tunnels because it didn't break up. They tested the wind tunnels, the turbulence, with kites, traditional kites, and they broke up because they had sticks in it. And this joker comes up with a non-rigid kite, and he captures the world. And that's how I got interested in kites. He asked me to show him the way to the Astor Hotel because that's where the scientific group was meeting. But before he went to the Astor Hotel to read a scientific paper, he took me into the park. I lived in Central Park West. We went across the street, and I flew my first kite at the age of 35 or 36. Before that, I just, you know, ran around, played baseball, and chased girls like every other red-blooded American boy.
Well, it paid off for Benjamin Franklin, so.
Yes, he nearly killed a million people with that experiment of his when he translated lightning into electricity,
yeah,
because he didn't describe in his experiments how to ground the key, how to ground the wire. And if you, he wrote up the experiment 17 years after he had witnessed it in France when he was ambassador there. I've tried to correct that in this book so that we'll have less casualties.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Let's get back to your radio career. You wrote for a number of radio shows, I guess, during the 30s.
May I just interrupt once more on kites? I'll tell you why. Mark Coney sent the first antenna up on a radio.
That's right.
That's right.
Up in Newfoundland.
He sent it up on a kite.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And received the letter S, I believe, didn't he?
I think so.
Well, you combine both careers.
Okay.
And radio.
Now we can tie it in perfectly.
Right. You're able to bring it in here, Dick.
How did you start writing for radio?
Well, I was working for City News Service in New York City. And one time I covered a story about Phillips H. Lord. And he liked what I did. He asked me to try my hand on gangbuster stuff because I had a little reputation on crime stories. And so I started by... he had terrific research. And he asked me to do some of the research. Then he asked me to do, a sample story. I remember the first one was the Wilkes-Barre Christmas murders. A gang of guys were sending Christmas presents through the mail to a lot of the mine people.
Mm-hmm.
And these Christmas presents blew these people up. Very, very effective way of disposing of your enemy. Send them a Christmas package and boom.
And these were true
incidents. These are all true incidents. Phillips H. Lord hired, actors were involved.
Yes.
But once in a while, they had a sheriff on. Anyway, I tried one or two of the stories. He liked it. But more than that, I took over all the gangbuster stories, and I made them into a series of gangbuster stories for the King Feature Syndicate. And they played in a double spread across the then Daily Mirror. Remember the Hearst paper, the
sure
Daily
do.
Mirror?
Mm-hmm.
And they ran every Sunday. First they went on the air, and then you remember the prisoner walk,
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was very vivid. It was very, very dramatic. And I took them and translated them into kind of a Sunday feature. I did not get a byline on it. It was a Phillips H. Lord byline, but I got all the money. I was satisfied with that.
Took the money instead of the glory.
That's right. And I recommend that to other people, to other writers.
Did they pay well for those days?
I got more from the syndicate rights than I did from, and at that time, this is 1937, 38, 39, I got, I think, about $100 a show. And that was a lot of money in those days.
That's right. That's right.
I was very facile, and I could do two shows a week. I would write in advance. So I'd get $200 a week. Just from the
so
radio.
You were working on a freelance basis then for Phillips H.
Well, no, I was on his staff.
Well, you were?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But I did other things for him. I started his with him on We the People, for example, which he also had at the time, which he developed for Young and Rubicam. And he gave me credit for starting it with him. So when he got ready to fire me about 3 years later, I pointed out to the to the clipping that said that I had helped him start it and develop it and worked with him on it. He said, I never saw that before in my life, So I slunk off, defeated as usual. Phillips H. Lord was a very slick guy. He was a terrific operator. You would write a show, it would take you all week to write the show, and he would come up to rehearsal time with about 1 hour to go, and he would rewrite the whole thing. It was very discouraging. You thought you had a good show.
Yeah.
But he was terrific. Of course, he overreached himself with that boat of his, that story about the Seth Parker.
I remember the character, yeah. Seth Parker.
Seth Parker was the name of a boat. When he first started, he was essentially a promoter, but he was a very good one. And he was a great lover of the sea. He always wanted to be out sailing. So he bought a boat, a very large schooner. It was about 60, 70 feet. But his entrepreneurial instincts were such that he wouldn't just go out and take a crew and go around the world, which is what he wanted to do, or go to the South Sea Islands, which he loved to dream about. Instead, he started promoting it. He got General Foods to stock the boat with food, so he had to sign a contract whereby he was going to do some publicity for them. And then he got a refrigerator built into the boat so he can go into the southern water, so he had a contract with General Electric or General Motors or something. Then he had a contract with a radio network. I think it was the Blue Network at the time. And he had a contract with them to do a Seth Parker broadcast every week, an hour show every week. And off he sails with a boat stocked with all free goods, for which he had to do some commercials. The first week, he had a crew made up mostly of radio engineers and radio actors and all that, people who were attracted to his type of vagabondage. And they're out for the first week, and they do a broadcast from the ship. They're somewhere out near Cuba or something. And everything's fine, but it's a pretty dull program. You know, there's nothing much to report about what's going on. And besides, you have to give so much credit to one show or another, I mean, one product or another. It's full of commercials. You know, he started getting complaints. The second week, you know, he figured out he had to do something to brighten up the show. So sure enough, he starts to fake it a little bit. He says, the boat is in trouble. We're in trouble, you know. I need help, SOS. He sent out all kinds of avis, all kinds of warnings, you know. We're in trouble. But he'd always get out of the trouble at the end of the hour. That was the second. Third week, there's very little reaction to his program. He gets more and more dramatic. About fourth or fifth week, they're way out somewhere, almost in the South Sea somewhere. And things are really dull. And he has to deliver an hour show. So he starts in sending out distress calls, this time very serious ones. And sure enough, he attracts a British boat, a whole flotilla. And heading the flotilla is His Majesty the King's boat with the Prince of Wales on it. And they come to his rescue just before they arrive. The broadcast is over, and this whole British flotilla that went to their rescue is told to please turn around. We're okay. Always just before the show ended. The sixth, seventh week, where nothing much happened, but eighth or ninth week, again, they need a hypo. So sure enough, again, one of these SOSs goes out. And of course, the audience, he had a tremendous audience by now. The Voyage of the Seth Parker. I think you're not old enough to remember it.
I don't remember this one.
But they went along. And this time, they're in real trouble. The boat is sinking. It was an old boat.
Them, right?
Nobody
they did believe him. And the same flotilla is in the neighborhood with the Prince of Wales. Of course, it makes international news. And they come around again this time. They're near Hawaii by now. And sure enough, the flotilla comes in sight, you know, and says, you either come aboard and abandon your ship or we'll tow you in. And Phillips H. Lord said, no, I'm going to stick it out with my men. I'm going down with my ship. And they said, nuts to you. Do you want to come aboard or we'll just take you in? Half the crew rebelled and went aboard. They were really sinking this time.
Sure. Right?
The boat was breaking up. And Lord finally said, all right. And he gave in, but in time to finish the broadcast. But he did go aboard. He realized that he was in trouble. The boat, the Seth Parker, was towed into Honolulu Harbor, and it stayed there. And Phillips H. Lord was a busted man. He couldn't come back to the United States. All his contracts were busted. All the commercials that he had were no longer valid. But he stayed on the beach for a year. He claims he married a Hawaiian princess. He saw the Southern Cross in the sky one night, and he said, I must go back to America, take my punishment. He raised enough money, left his Hawaiian princess, came back to America on a boat. He left his boat, and his Seth Parker became a nightclub boat. He scrounged enough money to come back to the United States, and before he reached New York City, he had already had the outlines of the great show, the FBI, which later became Gangbusters when they couldn't use the name of the FBI in War and Peace.
That's a great story. Okay. Would you like to hear Gangbusters right now?
Yes, yeah, I got one here I think you'll enjoy, Dick, so why don't we spin the tape.
And now, in cooperation with police and federal law enforcement departments throughout the United States, the only national program that brings you authentic police case histories. Gangbusters.
Jim Braddock narrates the case of the Jersey Butcher Bandit, who netted a quarter of a million in hot dollars until persistent detectives matched a cream-colored sedan with a snapshot taken on a bathing beach.
Gangbusters has a special narrator for tonight's case, former heavyweight champion of the world, Jim Braddock.
The inside facts in the case of the Jersey Butcher Bandits.
You know, Mr. Braddock, Gangbusters listeners usually expect to hear our case histories narrated by police officials.
I know it, Don Gardner, and the name is Jim. The two detectives who worked on it are close friends of mine. One of them was my sparring partner. I saw them work for 48 hours without sleep and for weeks without taking a day off. So I called you up. I thought that I, as a citizen, should come and tell other citizens what our police are doing to protect us.
Well, when you got in touch with us, Jim, we thought it would be a splendid idea, so why don't you go right ahead?
All right, Don. Suppose we begin one day last summer. Several longshoremen were stretched out in the shade of large packing cases on the dock at Hoboken, New Jersey. They had finished their lunch and were waiting for the whistle before they went back loading the freighter that was tied up alongside. The conversation actually had turned to a subject on which they were all experts.
Yeah, and I'm telling you, that's what he did it in.
Huh, 141 and 3/5. You're talking through your hat, Sud. You don't know a thing about it.
Who don't know a thing about what? Where do you get off at being such a man with the figures?
I'm telling you, no horse ever ran a mile in a 16th in that time unless it was downhill and a truck was pulling him.
Oh, you don't think so, huh? How about that, though? He says, I'm a liar, practically.
Be a liar. Who cares?
I care, that's so. No horse ever ran it in 141 and 3/5.
Okay, Sud, you got your opinion. How'd you like to back it up with a little cash?
Sure, I like to back it up with a little cash. And you can look it up in any record book you got.
You're wrong. For how much?
You name it. Anything up to $5.
Okay, that's enough talk about horses.
You mean $500?
What do you think I mean, cigar coupon?
All right, there's the whistle.
Talk about it later. Let's get back to work. Oh, my back. Why do we always get tracked?
500. He never saw 500.
Didn't I? I'll show you what.
Sud.
I never saw $5.
If that whistle hadn't have blown, Sud, it'd have kicked you right in the face.
Oh, for crying out loud, for what did I do?
500. What do you think we're working this dock wallop was for, to show how much money we got? Now get to work.
Okay, okay.
I'll see you after the shift. We'll pick up Whitey and go over the deal for tonight. Yes?
Mike Hoser. Sorry if I woke you, Pat, but those boys have been at it again.
Another butcher?
Yep. They broke in the house, took $4,000 the guy had in his desk.
The butchers don't stop keeping so much cash around the house, they'll all be broke.
Well, there might be an angle in this one.
Yeah?
We got hold of a fellow who lives down the street from the butcher. He saw a car around earlier that looked suspicious.
Oh, well, what kind of a car?
A cream-colored job, a sedan. A late model, New Jersey license.
Oh.
He got the last two numbers, 9-1, but that's all he could make out.
Well, it's better than nothing. I'll get dressed and come on down, Hoser. Where are you?
Chief of Regio's office.
Okay, you wait there for me. I'll see you in 20 minutes.
What a racket, what a racket. Butchers.
Just look where you're driving, Suds. We know it's good.
How about it, Whitey? Did you ever see anything so soft? It's like standing out in the rain with a bucket. You can't help catching something.
Suds, you put it quaintly.
Listen to him, Phil. I put it quaintly. What was so quaint about that $4,000 tonight?
All right, stop jabbering about it, will you?
What do you say we all go out and celebrate?
You two go ahead. Just drop me there at the next corner.
What's the matter, Whitey?
Nothing's the matter. I've got a date.
Yeah? With who?
Oh, you don't know her, Phil.
Then I bet you don't want her. Did you ever meet one of them tonight as he runs with?
What do you say we come with you, Whitey?
I'll buy you a drink.
Oh, some other time. You don't mind, Phil. Not tonight.
No, not tonight, Phil. He's all engaged. Stop.
What are you looking for, Suds?
Me, you want an idol?
Just stop the car and let me out. Stop it, Suds.
Okay.
You be in touch with me, Phil?
I'll be in touch with you.
Good night. Thanks.
So long, Whitey.
What's he thanking you for?
How should I know? Get going.
Okay, okay.
Take it easy, Ray. You want to buy me a new clutch?
Look, Phil.
Don't get sore at me just because Whitey ain't sociable. Guy's going to be a favorite. We ought to act like one. Not like somebody from a dancing school.
All right, that's enough.
Yeah. Well, what's he doing while we're breaking that back stock walloping? He don't like to talk to us. I like to know what he tells those fancy dames of his.
But just remember one thing. Without Whitey, we're not in business. No Whitey, no butchers. No butchers, no dough.
Well, we can dig up some other guy. There's a million guys that can get information like that.
Look, Suds, I'll take care of the personnel problems around here. You just drive. I want to get to bed.
Hello, Chief Reggio.
Hello, Chief.
See, Sullivan.
Thanks, Chief.
Thanks. All right, now, what's this idea?
Well, we thought Chief...
You tell him, Fred.
Okay. Chief, we know the last two numbers of the car. We know it was a cream-colored job, probably a Dodge. Now, we want to go through all the Jersey registrations and see if we can't locate a car that fits that description with the last two numbers, 9-1.
Well, you know there's over a million cars registered in the state.
We know it, Chief.
And that car might not even have been involved in the burglary last night.
So you don't think it's such a good idea, then?
Oh, just a minute, Sergeant. Who said it wasn't a good idea? These men have burglarized the homes and held up the shops of a dozen butchers. Their take has run to nearly $250,000. If there's any chance at all of getting them, I'm for it.
Okay, Chief. We'll get busy on the registrations right away.
Just a minute. Uh-huh. Let me call Trenton. I think their card sorting machines can save you a little work checking through those registration lists.
Well, where is he? Well, he's sitting around his joint all night. Not that I mind.
Well, if you don't mind, shut up about it.
Look, Phil, why don't we have to keep worrying about Whitey for? Let's forget about the guy and do this on our own.
Get some sense, will you?
Now, there's guys with dough besides butchers.
I'll take the butchers, and so will you. They're in the kind of business where they can lay away a lot of cash, and they're doing it.
Okay, but Whitey ain't the only guy that can get information. I know a guy in Bayonne.
I know 40 guys in Bayonne, but there isn't one that's got Whitey's touch. We need him, so lay off, will you?
I'm sick of that guy. I'm moping around all the time about a dame. One dame. How about that?
All right, here he comes. Keep quiet.
Quiet. The quiet I'm over the edges was.
Hello, Phil. Suds.
I'm sorry.
Well, that's all right. Time don't mean nothing to us.
Sit down, Woody.
Thanks. What do you want to drink? An orange blossom?
Listen, you have had enough of your wisecracks.
Yeah, college boy. Well, who
all
do you
right.
think?
Cut it out. Now, listen to me. I'll tell you how we worked the deal tonight.
Before you do, Phil, I've got something to say.
Well, get it off your chest. We got business.
What is it, Woody?
I've been doing a lot of thinking the last couple of days, Phil.
So?
Tonight's my last job. I'm quitting.
You what?
I'm through. I'm quitting.
Good. Glad to hear it.
Suds. And, why are you quitting?
I want to get married.
Well, get married. Who cares if you're married? You gave us another couple of months' work, Whitey. And I want you along.
I'm through, Phil. After tonight.
Well, let's buy a drink and celebrate.
Suds. Wait for us in the car.
But, Phil,
wait for us in the car.
Okay. See you outside, but make it snappy.
Who's the girl, Whitey? That Kay?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Nice dish. You wouldn't like her to find out what you do for a living, would you?
You crack a word to her, Phil, and I'll kill you, I swear.
Don't make me laugh, Whitey. You're not the killing kind. You got more sense. We made $250,000, Whitey. This is a big-time operation. Clean and safe. I want to keep it up. Remember that. Let's go.
Tonight's the last one, Phil.
Is it?
Gangbusters, the great Phillips H. Lord series. Our guest tonight is Will Yolen. We'll get back to him in just a moment.
The Cromwell Savings Bank Division of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank, located on Main Street in Cromwell, has been serving the people of Cromwell with every banking need since 1871. And it was just 1 year ago last Monday that the Cromwell Plaza office opened its doors to serve you as well in the old neighborly Cromwell tradition. At either Cromwell Savings Bank Division, you'll find the same friendly and dependable service, the same personal attention on all your banking needs. And both offices are open Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 12 noon for your convenience. The first and oldest Cromwell Savings Bank office is at the corner of Main and West Streets. It's open Monday through Wednesday from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m., Thursdays from 9 to 5, and Fridays from 9 to 7:30. The newer Cromwell Plaza office is conveniently located next to Kmart and is open Monday through Wednesday from 10 to 4:30, Thursday from 10 to 5, Friday from 10 to 7:30. In addition, you'll find plenty of free and convenient parking adjacent to both Cromwell Savings Bank Division offices of Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank. Stop in soon. They look forward to serving your family for the next 100 years. Member FDIC. And now, back to Dick Bertel.
Will Yolen is our guest tonight on the Golden Age of Radio. We're talking about some of the early shows that Will wrote. Will has written many things since, and not only in radio, and in motion pictures as well. We'll get to that in just a moment. But I do want to ask you about some of the soap operas that you were responsible for. Will, you wrote, among others, Pepper Young's Family.
Well, I did. You know, I was one of a number of writers. They have millions of writers.
Sure.
And we used to get an outline from the Blackett Semple Hummert Agency, and we would fill in the dialogue, or we would come up with some special material, and they'd ask us to work it up. And there were so many shows. At that time, I think the wage scale was anywhere from 150 to 250, and that was a lot of money in those days. During the war, I used the experience of writing these shows when I worked for I was the managing editor of the secret radio station in London. And I could pound out so much copy. You know, I remember the days when I could do two scripts a day. And I got a staff, I formed up a staff, and we had this, the first American voice in the world. You know, Colonel Britton had been discredited during the war because the Nazis could imitate his voice. They broke his code and everything. We were the first new voice. Mark Blitzstein wrote the theme. It was Yankee Doodle Dandy and sort of a very jazzy coda. And I handled the news. I handled the basic news, that is, I and a staff of 40. But I was the managing editor. I had recruited these people, got them from the Navy, the Army. I was in London at the time. And we opened the station. It was very, very secret. We had to send out avis, the warnings to the boatmen in different waters to get them out of the water because we were going to bomb certain areas. Or we sent news to the different undergrounds in France or in the Netherlands and so forth. And because the Nazis were sending these broadcasts into the undergrounds to bring them up prematurely so they could knock them off, and we had to be very careful how we worked with them. But the fact is that I, who had been working at Warner Brothers when I went into the service, was stationed in this very secret place on Wardour Street, which was across the street from the London office of Warner Brothers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there I was, right back in Warner Brothers, but in London. And the emphasis was on secrecy, and the London Daily Mail, in announcing the beginning of this secret radio service, published the address of the place and blew out cover on the first day. We overcame that.
I'm glad to hear that.
Was this all shortwave type broadcasting? And how did you actually keep in track with the...
Well, we set up the basic news, and then the language desks, in French or German, not German, but in... although we did have a black news broadcast aimed at the Luftwaffe. The Luftwaffe was the only people who could have a radio, who could receive. Otherwise, it was penalty of death, you know, if you had a radio and you were receiving enemy broadcasts. So we didn't know who our listeners were, but once in a while somebody would walk in with a safety pass and say, "I heard your broadcast. You told us how to come in and so forth." And that was the only results we could measure.
Well, at least they were results.
Yeah.
Well, Dick, I have something from that period you might want to hear. You know, Glenn Miller, before his untimely death, he did a lot of broadcasts in London. And I have a show where he actually spoke German when he was directing this to the Luftwaffe.
Bing Crosby did the same thing when I was with him. Bob Musil and I set him up. I mean, Bob introduced him to our broadcast. Bing was the only one whose name was still known in those days to the Germans, the French, the Danish, and people like that. But he couldn't speak German, so we did a phonetic broadcast of his picture, his song, "In Going My Way," and he sang it in German, phonetically.
Yeah.
And the next day, or the same day, I was sharing a flat with Bob Musil of the UP. He was a Night City editor in London of the UP, then UP, now UPI. And he said, "I hear you had Bing Crosby on. What did you call him?" I said, "Well, he was our secret weapon. What did you call him?" He said, "Well, call him the Bingle." And that's how he got the name. Bob sent it to the... he was not only UPI car's chief of the night side, but he was also the Variety correspondent. So it appeared first in Variety. That's ahead of his own service.
That's a great story.
Gee, I never knew that.
Let's get back to the Glenn Miller broadcast.
Yeah, Dick, see whether you can recognize the voice and the music.
Okay.
Ich habe da something special.
Sie meinen etwas Spezielles.
Good. Was Spezielles? Hier ist das Spezielle, und zwar der romantische Sergeant Johnny Desmond. Sieht gar nicht so aus, aber ist romantisch. You'll sing Now I Know.
Feldwebel Johnny Desmond singt jetzt den Schlager Now I Know. Auf Deutsch, ich verstehe.
Sie versteht, ich verstehe, versteht.
Jetzt gut sehen, warum glücklich durchs Leben ich geh, ach es kann mir nicht klar, ob's nur scheint, aber kann. Es kann nur Liebe sein. Ich versteh jetzt und seh, dass mir die Welt nun gefällt wie noch nie. Dass ich bin, Stimmung bin, aber wie? Felsen fällt, sind den Sorgen des Tages, ohne Tadel nicht sein. Ich bin da. Weil das Schicksal allein es geplant, dass du mein nie erträumt, nicht im vollsten Traum. Hätte ich je ein Gefühl so wie dir, jetzt es mich glücklich sein.
Das war schön. Vielen Dank, Feldwebel Desmond.
Bitte schön.
Glenn Miller from a broadcast in the early 40s during the war, beamed toward the German audience. We'll get back to our guest, Will Yolen, in just a moment.
Tomorrow's dreams will be financed with today's savings. And when you open a savings account at Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank or its Cromwell Savings Bank division, you not only get a variety of savings plans to choose from, you also get the greatest interest available by law. What's more, the passbook they give you may be used at any of their 6 conveniently located offices. Build a solid foundation for your future with a savings account at Cromwell Savings at the corner of Main and West Streets or the Cromwell Plaza office next to Kmart in Cromwell. Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has 4 offices to serve you, 2 in Middletown and branches in Montville and Colchester. Stop in soon. All offices are open Saturdays from 9 to noon, except the Farmers and Mechanics Main Street office in Middletown. In addition to the convenience of one-stop banking and convenient hours, you'll also find plenty of free parking. Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank and Cromwell Savings Bank Division are members of FDIC. And now back to your host, Dick Bertel.
Will Yolen is our guest tonight. Will Yolen is a writer. He is also a philosopher of sorts. And one of the most expert people as far as flying kites in America goes. But we're talking not about kites, we're talking about radio, we're talking about movies, and we'd like to get back. I certainly would like to hear about your association with Warner Brothers, because you wrote a lot of great scripts. You were involved with the production of Sergeant York.
I did that, and I also was in there. I was the promotion manager at one time. I wrote the report that made it possible for them to change their whole concept of advertising and publicity, because about 1940, the motion picture companies took a consent decree and they had to divest themselves of their theaters. So I wrote the report, which stood for the whole industry and which changed the whole concept from production publicity into box office publicity. Because they could only sell pictures 5 at a time, no more years output, no more selling them 20 pictures a year. But now it was just a block of five. And that meant that the emphasis was now on box office publicity. When a picture played in box office, when played in the theater, that's when they started to sell it. And that meant that all the big publicity departments on the West Coast had to be moved east to New York, where they had the sales, distribution, and promotion departments. So I, who had just bought a house on the West Coast 3 months before, was told to move me and my whole department back east, which I had left only 3 months earlier.
Let's talk about Sergeant York. What was your role there?
Sergeant York, I made the first meet with him. I went down to Three Forks of the Wolf River in
Tennessee.
Pall Mall, Tennessee. Oh. Not Pall Mall, it was really called Pall Mall. How they ever got that name on
there. Yeah, he changed it around.
And I had been, I had known him, I had met him as a newspaper man. I had met him at a convention in New York City, the American Legion convention. And he remembered me. So when Warner Brothers bought the rights to the picture, they realized that nobody knew who Sergeant York was, the younger people, the people who were going to the movies. So they said, well, we got to do something. We got to bring back Sergeant York into the public ken. So I went down there because I knew him. And I had talked to him by phone a few times, and I wrote some letters to him. I got on a plane, went down to Chattanooga, and I rented a car and drove up to his general store. He had a general store with a platform, loading platform, and there he was sitting there with a bottle of Coke, and he sees me there. Now, we'd been writing to each other and talking on the phone and all that. He said, "Well, hello, Will," he says. "What you doing here?"
You told him just passing.
I never had a meal going through without saying hello to him, Alvin. So we, he finally recognized what I was there for, and I wrote the first shot of, you know, the, not the working strip, but the backgrounders and things like that. He was a very fine man, but he was a religious nut. And the money that he got from Warner Brothers, and it was a considerable sum, was turned back into Bible schools. He had a lot of friends there in the under the mountain, as they call it, but he also had a lot of people who didn't like him because he ran a general store. If anybody else wanted to open a store or anything, he would become very competitive. He'd drive them out. He wouldn't let anybody else share in what little wealth there was there. And don't forget, there were very primitive people there.
Mm-hmm.
And he got all this glory. He got an awful lot of money for his lawyer. You know, everybody was very protective about him. You know, he was like a national monument. When he came to New York, when the picture was opened, and we had the press in to interview him, he had seen the picture at a special screening. Gary Cooper was a star. And we had this great press meeting at the Waldorf Astoria. He had a big suite, and he was really, he looked very, very lavish. And the newspapermen wanted him, "How did you like Gary in your role?" And he said, very straight-facedly, "That Cooper sure can't shoot."
That's a great story. Well, it's time for another excerpt from your collection. And, Will, you were involved with We the People. I wish we could bring Sergeant York back, but we can't. You did some of the research, I guess, on We the People, didn't
you? Oh, yes, yes. I did quite a bit of it, as a matter of fact. And I also handled a lot of the people. I did some of the interviews with them. Some of the people were real fakes. You couldn't tell, though. You know,
yeah.
I remember one person who came from the Ozarks. Little old lady, beautiful, wearing the clothes of the Ozark Mountains. And she came up and she told a wonderful story on the air that I wrote, telling about how she wanted to come up and see the big city, that everything was, you know, so new, everything was so bright, everything was so beautiful. And she would like to bring up her little son, who had never been to anything. He hadn't even been to Berthens or Berrien's. And would we please invite her up, you know, again, so that she could bring her son, who had never seen a Berrien, because he was short, and all the men in the mountains were very tall, so he couldn't look over to look into the grave. well, we made arrangements to bring them up again. It was a very charming couple. While she was in New York, she was also interviewed by Hedy Kotel of the Daily Mirror and Bill Hines, who was quite a novelist and quite a writer of the New York Sun. The New York Sun existed at the time. And they fell in love with her, and I fell in love with her. And we bought some land from her in the Ozarks. I kept that land for 30 years before I found out she didn't own it. Nobody owned it, but she sold it to us, to a couple of hard-boiled newspaper people. Years later, on her deathbed, she confessed that not only was she not, she was from the Ozarks, but she had been in New York. She was glad to come to New York to be on the show because she had been working on a book herself. And she wanted to meet with her publisher. She had no money, so she used this as a way to get to New York City.
Beautiful. Ed, how about We the People?
The Gulf Oil Companies and your neighborhood Good Gulf dealer present We the People. That old favorite, Love and Boom, you know you're in for fun and laughter. For that's the song that means Jack Benny's on the air. But tonight, Love and Boom has an even more special meaning. For it's the 20th wedding anniversary of Jack Benny and his famous partner, Mary Livingston, one of Hollywood's most happily married couples. What's the secret behind this happy marriage? Well, tonight you're going to hear the answer from Jack and Mary themselves. So come in, Hollywood.
Congratulations, Jack Benny and Mary Livingston, on your 20th wedding anniversary, and welcome to We the People.
Thank you, Tom Hanlon.
Well, how about thanking me? I did the time.
Now, Mary, wait, it hasn't been that bad.
Maybe not. Anyhow, I won a bet.
A bet? On our 20th anniversary?
Yeah. 20 years ago, a woman bet me I couldn't stand you this long.
That sounds just like your mother.
Was your mother.
Well, she just didn't want to lose me, that's all.
And why was she trying to sell all the girls' raffle tickets?
Because your mother put her up to it.
Oh, Jack, you can't make me sorry. You can say anything you want about my mother.
Not on the air, I can't.
Oh, Jack, only joking, Tom. We're both very happy.
You and Jack?
No, me and my mother.
Mary, tell us about your honeymoon. Where did you go?
To Niagara Falls. It was wonderful. I could hardly wait to leave there for New York to tell Jack about the place.
Now, wait a minute, Mary. You mean you went on your honeymoon without Jack?
Yes, I had already seen the fall.
I think
everyone should see Niagara Falls, you know, even single people.
Well, supposing you tell me when the proposal took place.
It was a few months after we met. One night, Jack suddenly got down on one knee and proposed to me.
I did not.
You did, too.
Well, why don't you tell the truth, Mary? Listen, Tom, here's what happened. We were sitting on the sofa in Mary's room. She dropped her handkerchief on the floor. I bent down to pick it up. The minute I got down on my knee, she said, "Oh, Jack, this is so Southern." And between this and Southern, her mother called the preacher.
But, Jack, you really did propose to Mary, didn't you?
Yes, it was pretty tough, you know, with all those interruptions.
Interruptions?
Yeah, the next time I started to propose, her father came in, saw me on my knees, and yelled, "I'll fade you for any part of a dollar."
Oh, really? And what did you do this time, Mary?
I won $2 and bought the marriage license.
That's right, and I held up the bus for 2 hours. I also held Greenberg on third. Hiya, Hank.
Say, Mary, before you go, would you tell the folks what Jack gave you for an anniversary present?
Oh, the usual gift.
What's that?
A pair of shoelaces with plastic tips.
Now, Mary, why don't you tell them the truth? What about the car I gave you for your anniversary?
Did Jack really give you a car?
Uh-huh. A convertible coupe.
And what did you give Jack?
A convertible toupee.
Mary.
On a nice day, we both put our tops down.
Mary, you know, you didn't even kiss me for giving you that new car.
Well, if you really want a kiss, here it comes. Well, go on, Jack. The next line of the script is yours. Read the next line. fine.
Wait till I wipe the steam off my glasses. Good night, folks.
Good night.
We the people speak. This is Milo Bolton again reminding you to listen in next week. You'll meet ace comedian Milton Berle, and along with the music of Oscar Bradley, you'll also meet many other real people with real stories you hear only when the Gulf Oil Companies and your neighborhood Good Gulf dealer present We the People. This is PBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
We the People. Unfortunately, it's not the excerpt that Will Yellen was talking about. I wish we could have brought that one back, but we'll get back to our guest in a moment.
Perhaps 1976 is the year you've decided to improve your home's exterior appearance. Maybe it's a new driveway you need, or a complete landscaping job with new plantings for the front of your home. Or now with warm weather, the desire to own your own swimming pool or backyard patio may be stronger than ever. If that's the case, stop in and get complete information on a home improvement loan from the folks at Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank or Cromwell Savings Bank Division. Cromwell Savings Bank is located at the corner of Main and West Street and at the Cromwell Plaza office next to Kmart in Cromwell with convenient Saturday hours, 9 to noon. And Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank has four offices to serve you, two in Middletown and branches in Montville and Colchester. With the exception of the Middletown office on Main Street, they're also open Saturdays from 9 to noon. Stop in soon. Let them show you how a home improvement loan may take the cramp out of your family's lifestyle. Member FDIC, an equal housing lender. And now back to Dick Bertel.
Well, Will Yolen, I do want to thank you very much for being our guest tonight on the Golden Age of Radio and sharing some of these delightful stories with us. Do you think you'll ever do any more writing for radio or television?
No, I just want to go to sleep for a long, long while. I just came back from Russia, and it was a very strenuous affair.
Well, we'll give you the opportunity to get some rest then. Will Yolen has been our guest on the Golden Age of Radio. And until next time, this is Dick Bertel. Good night.
All the big night spots of New York town to hear the top songs of the week sung so clearly.
The Golden Age of Radio has been brought to you by WTIC and Farmers and Mechanics Savings Bank and their Cromwell Savings Bank Division. Hometown friends serving your best banking interests in every way. The Golden Age of Radio was produced by Bob Chirego and Dick Bertel.
Sony Home Permanent presents...
This is Nora Drake.
Buck Rogers in the 25th century.
Ah, don't touch that dial. Listen to...